this is Derek Frost from the Triangle Radio Reading Service. For the next hour, I'll be reading to you from the Triangle Business Journal. The content of this program is intended for a blind and print-impaired audience. And we start on the front page with the cover story headline for the Triangle Business Journal. Where have the community banks gone? Dramatic reduction of banks in North Carolina casts an ominous spell on small businesses. And that's the headline on the front page. The story begins inside the Triangle Business Journal with a second headline. Markets, capital, force a new paradigm, bigger institutions, but fewer banking options. And this article is written by Lauren K. Onasorge. It was the tail end of the recession in late 2009 when Scott Custer, the man who relocated Canadian Bank RBC's U.S. headquarters from Rocky Mount to Raleigh, and Adam Abram, who founded James River Insurance Company, took the plunge and started Piedmont Community Bank. Piedmont quickly flourished thanks in part to the fact that deals came easily post-recession, but the key factor, Custer says, is this. We were able to raise money. Securities filings show an initial $12 million from investors, cash pumped almost immediately into Piedmont's first deal. For a then $95 million asset, Vantage South, Piedmont was on its way. Through acquisitions, Piedmont would become the $7.5 billion Yatkin Financial, a giant among community banks in North Carolina. In a few months, if all goes as planned, the Yatkin name, like that of Piedmont, will vanish when it is acquired by Pittsburgh-based FNB Corporation. Just like every buyout, in the short run, there could be job losses, bank branch closures, and office relocations. Yatkin's story is reflective of the North Carolina community bank sector. While 92 banks were sprinkled around the state in 2008, just more than 50 exist today. According to S&P Global Market Intelligence, there were 113 banks and thrifts active in North Carolina at the end of 2008, with just 65 now. But 8 years ago, their assets added up to $2.35 trillion, an average of $20.8 billion per institution. Today, it's fewer banks, but a total of $1.97 trillion, meaning each institution averages nearly $30.3 billion in assets. There may be fewer banks, but like Yatkin, they've swelled in size. And bank startups? They just aren't happening, which has some concern that it may be harder for small businesses across the state to get loans. For a state like North Carolina, as large and as diverse as it is, to have just 50 banks, it's more than a little troubling, says Ray Grace, North Carolina Commissioner of Banks. It's a serious concern. The last bank startup. While nearly 30 banks were chartered in the state in the 5 years leading up to 2008, a new bank in 2016 is unheard of. The last bank to incorporate in North Carolina was Jacksonville-based Coastal Bank and Trust, which opened in 2009. Much of that, according to Lee Burrows, CEO of Charlotte-based Bank Street Partners, comes down to what Custer could get in 2009, capital. It's a hard case to make to your investors, Burrows says, pointing to low interest rates and the length of payback on investments. It's going to be very challenging to show a good return on a startup bank. So, more and more executives who a decade ago may have been building banks from scratch are buying and consolidating those institutions or avoiding the industry altogether in lieu of faster turnarounds. Chris Marinac, managing principal and director of research for Fig Partners LLC, says there's a lather, rinse, repeat cycle when it comes to banking, and eventually that cycle will return. At the end of the day, the market is growing, and when the market is growing, you have more businesses and more people, and they all need banking services, he says. Both Marinac and Burrow say, from a sheer numbers standpoint, the United States remains oversaturated when it comes to banks, and industry consolidation could be a needed correction. According to Bank Street Partners research, there are about 25,000 citizens for every bank in the United States. Compare that to Canada, which has nearly 44,000 people for every bank, or the United Kingdom, where that ratio is more than 158,000 people per institution, and they're fine, Burrow says. But many disagree. The small business hit. Dwayne Tollin, CEO of Rocky Mount-based financial advisor Tollin CFO, works exclusively with small to medium-sized businesses across the region. He says many of his customers find it more difficult than ever to find loans, particularly family-owned businesses where not everyone pulls a salary. Early-stage, pre-profit businesses have difficulty getting capital anyway, he points out. But with bigger banks, it's an even tougher sell. If you've got $10 billion in assets, you've got to keep out there. If you make a $50,000 loan, how many of them will you have to make? Dolan adds. The larger they are, you have to make fewer loans. That's consistent with what Bob Luddy, CEO of the $300 million Captive Air Systems in Raleigh, hears from his fellow professionals. For startups and small businesses, it's always a challenge to get money, and it's harder now than ever, he says. And Clyde Bailey, president of 64-year-old Raleigh-based Bailey's Fine Jewelry, found bank consolidation actually working in his favor. When he started, his banker was Rocky Mount-based Planters National Bank, which merged with People's Bank and Trust, becoming Centura Bank before being acquired by RBC, which was bought out by PNC. The $358 billion bank Bailey's still partners with today. Bailey's leveraged the more comprehensive services portfolio offered by PNC, which had invested in tech-savvy products that helped automate some of the financial processes Bailey's was doing in-house, features that ended up saving the jeweler money. And today, the jeweler has gone from having significant short-term inventory debt to being an interest-bearing investor with a handful of leftover long-term loans. It's not always a bad thing, he says of consolidation. What you might inherit are broader services. Gaurav Patel, the restaurateur behind Echelon Experiences, the Raleigh company whose restaurants include Haymaker and Edwards Mill Bar and Grill, says he too has been lucky when it comes to bank consolidation. His relationship with bankers at Yakin has been consistent throughout its acquisition, he says. We feel like those relationships are still there, he says, adding that he's not worried about the pending merger with FNB just based on Yakin's deal history. But both Bailey and Patel say relationships built with banks are the driving decisions behind their selections, and Bailey worries that consolidation could lead to bigger banks that just don't value relationships with lower deposit businesses. Grace shares that worry. Community banks in particular seem to be focused very keenly on their local markets and the specific unique needs of those local markets, while bigger banks tend to focus on larger, more lucrative markets and their loan bias. It's bias toward very large loans, he says. Numbers from Harvard University, researchers back him up, as a 2015 study shows that community banks provide more than half of the loans going to small businesses, despite making up just 20% of bank assets overall. Why new banks aren't taking root. Grace cautions that the industry is cyclic and we're not in a normal cycle, but there are some factors conducive to a bank startup in 2016, such as his take that fewer small banks scattered across rural parts of the state means pent-up demand for community banks. Unfortunately, the economy is still a little bit tepid, he says, and other than advising would-be investors on the process of submitting a charter application, there's little his office can do to usher in new banks, he says. He does say his office can turn around a charter application in about 60 days, quick compared to the FDIC process. But the biggest barrier isn't bureaucracy. It's money, and the capital needed to get started varies from $20 million to $50 million, depending on whether a bank is targeting a rural or metropolitan market, says North Carolina Bankers Association CEO Peter Gwaltney. And the money stays put for years. With near zero interest rates and pressure from regulators only approving business plans showing banks can be profitable within 3 years of inception, fast returns are a near impossibility. So, investors wanting a quicker buck have more luck investing in a tech startup, real estate, or even the stock market. Tom Hendrickson, a Raleigh businessman who was among the initial investors of North State Bank, says it's not just the capital, but the pedigree. One of the reasons he teamed up with North State Bank was his relationship with its co-founder, former CEO Larry Barber. Without it, he and his money would have stayed on the sidelines. Part of it is having that core team, the folks in the community that will commit to come behind that startup, he says. An outsider would be less likely to get that community support and its dollars in starting that bank. Why it matters. Gray says the decline in bank numbers is alarming. While the United States has more banks than its peer nations, that's because it's just evolved differently, he explains. The rural nature and distribution of communities made the 350 banks the state of North Carolina had in the 1940s necessary. Today, it's 53 banks, with the total expected to be just 50 by the end of the year, he says. While Gwaltney says people have loosely asked NCBA about the application process, he hasn't heard of any investors seriously considering a new bank venture in the past 24 months. In addition to small business concerns, he says communities that have lost their hometown bank have often lost a source of community pride. Having a bank, it's a sign of economic vitality, he says, and it's not just North Carolina. He notes the country has about 40% fewer banks today than when the Dodd-Frank Wall Street Reform Act, passed in response to the recession and implementing the most significant changes to financial regulation since the Great Depression, was signed in 2010. Proponents of the measure said it would reduce the risk of another financial crisis by decreasing the concentration of resources in a handful of banks. Gwaltney says it's done the exact opposite. The 5 or 10 largest banks in the country are larger than they were at the passage of Dodd-Frank, he says. What's next? Custer says the industry will find the proper balance. It will just take time. There probably were too many community banks, he says, and because there were too many, many of them stretched for business, probably did the wrong kinds of business. The recession, however, highlighted those issues and brought on widespread consolidation. Consolidation occurred at probably a more rapid case than it ever had in the past, he says, but you went from too many banks to where we're headed, where there's too few. He says the rise of digital lending could change the tide yet again. Now the trick is, how do we make the deposit gathering part of the business equally as mobile and electronic friendly, he says. Whoever cracks that code first is going to be ahead of the game. That could lead to the future of bank startups. And now in the Triangle Business Journal, we turn to Biz, a quick glance at Triangle happenings, written by managing editor Dane Huffman. The main headline, UNC's Daily Tar Heel isn't daily anymore. The new racks for the Daily Tar Heel will be empty Tuesdays as the sweeping changes in news consumption reach the student newspaper at UNC Chapel Hill and push it to search for new revenue streams. The DTH, now in its 123rd year, has enjoyed a steady run of talented journalists who were undergrads at UNC, from writers like Charles Kuralt to cartoonists like Jeff McNally. But the Internet's withering assault slashed at the nonprofit's financials, with the paper's investment account slipping from more than $1 million to around $400,000 today. That forced the newspaper's board and new general manager, Betsy O'Donovan, who officially started August 8, to look at options with a revamped effort on digital and new ways to reach consumers. We need to think of ourselves as connecting businesses to customers, says O'Donovan, a former editor at the Herald Sun in Durham and Nieman Fellow at Harvard University. She says the paper, which had a budget of $1.27 million in 2014, was running deficits north of $200,000 per year, even though students run the news part of the organization. We were running out of runway, O'Donovan says. We weren't as insulated as one might have hoped. Given those realities, the DTH decided to make a statement about its commitment to a new path by dropping the Tuesday editions starting August 31. The paper will still print on Election Day and any other Tuesdays that deserve a special, but otherwise the paper will pursue a question familiar to anyone who runs a business. You have to get back to the core question, what makes us valuable and how can we be more valuable, O'Donovan says. Durham's Novon files for public stock offering. Durham-based Novon has filed to go public and could raise as much as $60 million through an initial public offering. The company is led by Nate Stasko, 36, a co-founder in the company. Board members include Bob Ingram, the former Glaxo Welcome CEO and current member of Hatteras Venture Partners, though Hatteras is not an investor. Major investors include Neil Hunter, the former chairman and co-founder of Cree, and Malin Corporation. Also, the company had 63 employees as of the end of June, and 50 had stock options. Novon, which had raised more than $100 million in private offerings since 2009, is in the late stages of developing a treatment for acne that does not include antibiotics, an important distinction given the quickly rising rates of antibiotic resistance. Instead, Novan's experimental treatment called SB204 uses nitric oxide, something human bodies produce naturally, but which scientists have only recently learned to store and control more effectively. Google's high-speed project plods along. So which will happen first? Charlie Brown kicking that football or Google Fiber coming to the triangle? Google confirmed in 2015 that its ultra-fast Google Fiber was coming to the triangle someday. It celebrated with T-shirts and splashy websites, although a city official told Triangle Business Journal around that time that the start was at least 2 years away. And sure enough, the rollout of Google Fiber has been as slow as the early days of dial-up. Google has been largely silent, even with City of Raleigh officials lacking in specifics. The Wall Street Journal recently reported the Google Fiber push has stalled as the project, announced back in 2010, struggles to figure out how to reach homes. The journal said the company may be looking at wireless technology rather than the expensive addition of fiber optic cables. Asked about the progress of Google Fiber in the Triangle, a Google Fiber spokesman said, Google Fiber has been working steadily and surely since late 2015 on one of the biggest infrastructure projects ever undertaken in the Triangle. We're making great progress and looking forward to soon providing super-fast internet and other services to our Triangle cities. Allscripts employees lend a hand for Habitat. Allscripts is sponsoring a Habitat Wake house this fall, and 55 Allscripts employees were at the house early in the morning, August 24, to raise the first wall. The push is part of Allscripts' Give Back program. The house on Noose View Drive is one of 60 that Habitat Wake plans to build this year. Want to see NC State? Good luck! College football season is coming, and if you're looking for tickets to NC State University football games, you better hurry. The Wolfpack has sold a record 36,400 season tickets, beating the record 36,156 sold in 2007. And NCSU has fewer than 300 tickets for the home game with William & Mary on September 1, and fewer than 150 for the Old Dominion game on September 17. The Notre Dame game is completely sold out, and all other home games have only scattered tickets for sale, said Fred Demarest, Associate Athletics Director of Communications. There's a level of consistency in our fan base that's remarkable, Demarest said. It starts with the loyalty of the fan base. UNC Chapel Hill, by comparison, has sold 31,000 season tickets. Cyclists irked by RDU expansion plan. The future of Raleigh-Durham International Airport was a hot topic on Triangle Business Journal's website and social media outlets this week. On August 22, reporter Lauren Onisorge broke a story that a group of Triangle cyclists were speaking out against RDU's plan to use several acres of forested land for possible commercial development. On Facebook, some comments included, "Warehouses, hotels, rock quarries, and office space, just the things that people relocate here for. Come on, RDU, be world-class and think out of the box. It's a quality-of-life issue." That's from Buddy Kelly. "Some things are more important than the dollar." That's from Charles Rogan. And our last quote is from Bert Salt. "My point is that it's not their land to demand what can be done with it. Now, it's no harm to try to convince them otherwise, but in the end, it's not theirs to decide." And now we turn to the On Real Estate page, written by Amanda Hoyle. The main headline, "Some Raleigh businesses clash with tighter sign rules." Now that Raleigh is 6 months past adopting its new zoning map, a number of Raleigh business owners are finding out the hard way they now fall under another set of new rules that has completely changed regulations for signage at commercial properties across the city. In the past month, Lanier Riddick with Capital Sign Solutions says he has had several of his by-the-book sign applications denied by the city's zoning staff based on interpretation of the new zoning designations. Looking at a map of Raleigh, a majority percentage of commercial properties have one of those designations, he says, including North Hills, Cameron Village, and most buildings in downtown Raleigh. A lot of people are going to be surprised when they go in to apply for a new sign. Under the old rules, a business was allowed signage that was the equivalent of 2 square feet per every linear square foot of building frontage. So, a store like Great Outdoor Provision Company at Cameron Village, which has about 80 linear feet of store frontage, could install a sign as large as 160 square feet. Under the new rules, the maximum square footage of any sign under the new frontage designations is capped at 40 square feet, no matter the wall size. That's only slightly larger than a traditional piece of plywood that measures 32 square feet, he says. Rick Marcotte, the new owner of the former Audio Buys building at Five Points on Glenwood Avenue, he was among the first applicants in early July to have his sign application denied for a new 51-square-foot scripted sign advertising his wife's interiors business, Form and Function. The store is expected to relocate and open in the Five Points building around Labor Day. From my perspective, they have not explained the reason for denial, Marcotte says. This is a standard sign that's not unlike hundreds of others around town. The Marcottes will instead install a temporary vinyl sign on the windows until they can get the rules for the new building signage clarified. Raleigh City Attorney Tom McCormick was unavailable for comment, and a Raleigh Planning Zoning official referred questions to his supervisor. Roses is blooming. Georgia deal at Space means more growth for North Carolina retailer. Variety Wholesalers Incorporated, the Henderson-based owner of the Roses, Maxway, and Super 10 discount store companies, has signed a giant warehouse deal in central Georgia that will double the company's distribution capacity and its future store expansion goals. Wilson Sawyer, president and chief operating officer of the family-owned organization that has been around since 1949, confirms that the company has signed a long-term lease for 1.4 million square feet of space in a former Kmart distribution center in Noonan, Georgia. The deal, he says, will both alleviate some of the capacity constraints at the company's Henderson warehouse facility, where it employs about 450 people, and allow it to ramp up store expansions deeper into the southeast and southwest. The new Georgia facility is expected to create about 320 jobs in the Noonan community, about 45 miles southwest of Atlanta. Variety Wholesalers currently has 360 discount stores in 16 states, ranging from 5,000 to 10,000 square foot stores in its Super 10 division to the 30,000 to 70,000 square foot stores in its Roses division. The company has about 750 people based at its headquarters in Henderson. The company, Sawyer says, has been growing an average of 12 to 18 stores per year. With the additional capacity in Georgia, Sawyer says the company will start opening 30 to 40 stores per year. We've been looking for space for a while, and when this building came on the market, it was a good fit for us, Sawyer says. Our growth made it a necessity to add another distribution center to our network. LRC Properties of New York owns the building and has properties in Raleigh, Charlotte, and Winston-Salem. Developer planning new grocer in North Raleigh, but some neighbors don't like it. Members of several North Raleigh neighborhoods that protested a proposed Publix-anchored grocery store on Dunn Road in 2015 are taking aim at plans for a new grocery-anchored shopping center at nearby Raven Ridge Road. Nick Brown, a partner with DNN Development of Raleigh, says he had hoped to turn the crowd in support of his project at the corner of Falls of Neuse and Raven Ridge Roads in North Raleigh. However, the final vote at the North Citizens Advisory Council meeting on August 16 came out to nearly 90 residents for the project and more than 220 residents against it. The 17-acre project called Spencer Ridge is slated to have up to 128,000 square feet of retail and commercial space, including a 50,000 square foot anchor space reserved for a grocery store. And finally, under a section called residential, construction slows on apartments. Construction starts for new apartment buildings in the past 6 months dropped to its lowest level since 2011, as apartment developers and their lenders are being cautious about overbuilding in a market already saturated with new product. While absorption of new units has started to level off, it still exceeds the number of new units opening, each year. Veloxis enthused about transplant drug. That's the headline on the first article on the On Pharmaceuticals page written by Jason DeBruin. Craig Collard had kept a relatively low profile since leaving Kerry drug developer Cornerstone Therapeutics after Italy-based Chiesi Pharmaceutici took it private in early 2014. Now he has joined Veloxis as it transitions from a developmental stage drug company to a commercial stage and looking to grow revenue. Veloxis has developed a drug to help kidney transplant patients that reduces side effects like tremors. After a transplant, the body will look to reject the transplanted organ. The Veloxis drug, Envarsus, helps prevent the body from rejecting the new kidney. This kind of drug isn't new. In fact, the active drug is tacrolimus and is now available generically. However, the delivery is difficult to control and can cause serious side effects, especially in the mornings when the drug is first taken. Clinical studies by Veloxis show that its drug can control these side effects. The drug must be taken every day, and the concentration of the active drug delivered in the system can spike in the mornings. However, according to clinical trial data, the spike with Envarsus isn't nearly as drastic as it is with a competing drug called Prograf, and Collard expects doctors to switch their prescribing habits to Envarsus. Veloxis does not have an official superiority claim granted by the U.S. Food and Drug Administration, but Collard says, anecdotally, I think physicians really like this product. In the United States, there are about 200 centers that perform adult kidney transplants, and Collard says that 70% of those centers have at least tried Envarsus. As the drug gains traction, Collard expects Veloxis' market share to grow. The overall market is estimated at roughly $1.6 billion per year, so even a 20% share could mean annual revenues of $320 million. Veloxis employs 53 workers, including 16 sales representatives. Because the majority of kidney transplants in the country are performed by a relatively small number of doctors, Veloxis does not need a large sales team to get good penetration into the market. According to Veloxis market research, there were 17,200 transplants last year, with an expected annual growth rate of around 4%. There are some 185,000 patients with kidney transplants currently alive. Holly Hill expanding in East Raleigh. Holly Hill Hospital has received regulatory approval to add 32 adult inpatient psychiatric beds at its $15 million new building on the Michael J. Smith campus in East Raleigh. When completed, the campus will house 172 adult inpatient psychiatric, 60 child adolescent inpatient psychiatric, and 28 substance abuse beds. The campus is near the WakeMed Health and Hospitals Raleigh campus and UNC Wakebrook, the mental health hospital operated by UNC Healthcare. We are confident that building this new facility and increasing our adult inpatient services will help the community, especially Wake County, in many ways, said Michael S. McDonald, Jr., CEO of Holly Hill Hospital. From the patients in crisis who require around-the-clock care and active treatment, to the emergency departments who have been consistently overwhelmed by the influx of patients requiring mental health services, and finally to members of law enforcement who transport patients from across the state to our facility every day. Healthcare, including these mental health services, is tightly regulated in North Carolina, and Holly Hill needed regulatory approval from the North Carolina Department of Health and Human Services. Mental and behavioral health services are badly needed in Wake County and across North Carolina. Every year since 2009, Holly Hill has been over capacity, even during a time that it increased beds from 64 to 117. In 2014, the hospital recorded an occupancy rate of 150%. In 2015, Holly Hill deflected 3,754 adult patients because an inpatient bed was not available. Projections show the hospital will be profitable. By 2020, the third full year after the expansion opens, Holly Hill estimates it will record $44 million in revenue and $18 million in net profit. Biopharma CEOs believe markets are promising. Confidence among CEOs in the biopharma industry shot up in the second quarter following months of declining confidence in that sector. For example, CEOs who said they were very confident in their ability to raise capital in the public market increased from 18% in the first quarter to 39% in the second quarter, according to the latest Biopharma CEO Confidence Index. The survey, released in partnership between Kineticos, Ipsos Healthcare, and Demi Colton, announced the second quarter 2016 results of the Biopharma CEO Confidence Index. While most of the indicators showed a more positive feeling than in recent quarters, there was a continued decline in the outlook of a deal landscape. Survey respondents who labeled the overall deal landscape as good declined for a third straight quarter, and now two-thirds of survey participants no longer felt that way. Activist recalls diabetes drug with Durham ties. Activist, the generic drug unit that Allergan recently sold to Teva Pharmaceutical Industries, has recalled five lots of a diabetes drug that were manufactured under a contract by Durham-based Patheon. According to Patheon, a problem with the diabetes drug Glipizide arose after the size of the pill bottle was increased and a drying agent was included in the new bottle. The issue was not related to the manufacturing or packaging services provided by Patheon, according to a Patheon statement. And under a section called Quotable, the quote, "Interactions with Blue Cross Blue Shield have been ongoing, but disagreements on the findings persist. The department is going back in to do an additional examination and hopefully move toward a resolution." And that was from a statement from the North Carolina Department of Insurance announcing it would broaden its investigation into Blue Cross and Blue Shield of North Carolina. The initial examination dates back to information technology problems Blue Cross experienced in February. And finally, a big number, $495 million. Donations committed to UNC Chapel Hill last school year, breaking a record set just 1 year prior. And now we turn to the page written by Lauren Onasorge called On Technology. The main headline, ABB, ex-employees used trade secrets. Swiss-based power and automation technology giant ABB, which has its North American headquarters in Cary, has filed a federal lawsuit against a group of former employees making multiple allegations that they stole trade secrets and customers. Prior to the expiration of a non-compete clause, former ABB general manager John Rennie is accused in the suit of recruiting ABB employees to his new company, Peak Demand, and using trade secrets from ABB, claims he flatly denies in an August 22 email to Triangle Business Journal. According to the federal suit, defendants used details of ABB's existing supply agreement with Chinese firm Nanjing Zeta to steal its business, a move ABB claims had a big impact on ABB's Pine Tops manufacturing facility. Nanjing Zeta canceled its supply agreement with ABB, indicating the reason was ABB's failure to fulfill sales targets, according to the suit. But ABB blames sabotage for its inability to reach those targets. The complaint says that even while they worked for ABB, they were already plotting to start Peak Demand. Defendants developed a plan and strategy to try to cripple Pine Tops by soliciting ABB Pine Tops customers, undercutting ABB Pine Tops pricing, interfering with upper and vendor relationships, and raiding key employees from ABB Pine Tops, the complaint reads. The complaint, which asks for a jury trial and lists Wilson-based Peak Demand as a defendant alongside Rennie, the company's CEO, former ABB product manager Stephen Lindsay, former ABB product and design engineer Lee Wang, former ABB plant engineering manager Michael Bricker, and former ABB strategic sourcing employee Steve Chu, accuses the former employees of breach of contract, misappropriation of trade secrets, conversion, torturous interference with a contract, unfair and deceptive trade practices, and civil conspiracy. ABB is asking for a monetary judgment and that the defendants be ordered to segregate and return ABB's trade secrets. Rennie says all of the accusations in the complaint are false and that his team would be reviewing our options over the next several days. NC State Connection helps IBM develop talent, foster innovation. 3 months in, and IBM's new workspace at NC State University is doing exactly what execs at Big Blue said it would, foster young talent. In order for IBM to compete its transformation from a complete its transformation from a hardware-focused firm to one fully engaged in software-oriented services, think cloud computing and analytics, IBM needs to attract innovators, and it needs to do it now. It's imperative, says Fran O'Sullivan, IBM's research Triangle Park lead. There's major competition for the recruits, particularly in the Triangle, where companies such as SAS and Red Hat are all vying for people with similar skill sets, which is why IBM decided to go directly to the talent. Andrew Rindos heads university relationships on behalf of IBM and is an adjunct professor at NCSU. It's his job to figure out how the university, as well as other schools in North Carolina and across the Southeast, can tap into IBM technology and vice versa. In addition to talent scouting, he's introducing students to technology that he hopes they carry with them into the business world. Through partnerships with entrepreneurship competitions, he's helping IBM eye possible acquisition targets. The new center at Centennial Campus has intensified efforts already underway, he says. We really need to engage the students and train them to help us in this transition as we reinvent ourselves, he says. And it really is a reinvention. Where IBM used to almost exclusively work with computer sciences and engineering programs, today conversations are happening with folks from focus areas such as social sciences and medical sciences, anything that involves data, he says. IBM is making some of its technology available for free to students working on senior design projects, and it's already working to transform IBM's reputation. The company, which used to be known for the ThinkPad PCs and x86 servers coming out of Research Triangle Park, made a series of sales to Lenovo, exiting those hardware-focused businesses in lieu of higher growth strategy areas. It's not your father's IBM, he says. Not your parents' IBM, O'Sullivan corrects. Part of the goal is to show students and faculty that IBM is an innovator and not just dwelling on technology's past, and that and the reputation makeover too is working, says O'Sullivan. It's getting easier and easier, she says, calling newly hired employees out of the university system among Big Blue's best recruiting vehicles. It's those hires that tell their friends at NCSU about the innovation coming out of RTP, she says. Dolphin Tale, a story of perseverance. One of the researchers who found national acclaim after creating the first prosthetic tail, Fluke, custom-made for a famous dolphin, has some innovation advice. The ones that are bold about their concepts and ideas, they're the ones who make it. Kevin Carroll, the prosthetist, played by Morgan Freeman in the 2011 film Dolphin Tale, was in Raleigh to educate healthcare professionals and prosthetic users on innovations in the industry. There's lots of energy up here, he says, and the presence of the universities and Research Triangle Park could position the region for major innovation in prosthetics, he says. When developing a functional tail for Winter, a dolphin who had lost her tail after being caught in a crab trap in Florida, he faced many challenges. We put arms and legs on people, why not put a tail on a dolphin, he recalls saying. But, as in the movie, it's not as easy as just attaching a paddle to the mammal. Carol spent the better part of a year figuring out a device that Winter could wear that would help propel her through the water. We worked night times and weekends, he says. There was a lot of teamwork. In order for it to be successful, it's all about teamwork. Passenger count on the rise at RDU. Once again, the passenger count is increasing at Raleigh-Durham International Airport. Numbers from July show that the airport, currently developing a comprehensive plan to address traffic increases, continues to expand both in terms of flights and travelers. Total in-plane passengers increased nearly 8% to 508,317, up from just under 472,000 during July 2015. International travel, likely bolstered by the May addition of a direct service to Paris, is a contributing factor. In July, 14,398 in-plane travelers flew to international destinations. In July 2015, the total was just 9,361, a difference of nearly 54%. The average number of daily departures for July was 191, just a 1% increase from a year ago. And now in the Triangle Business Journal, we turn to the Viewpoint page, where we start with the editor's notebook written by Sugata Mukherjee, who is editor of Triangle Business Journal. The headline, Big Oil has a problem, and we all need to pay attention. A remarkable economic scenario is being played out on a global scale that, frankly, I did not think was feasible given market conditions. Oil companies are in big trouble. A drastic collapse of crude oil prices about 2 years ago eventually led crude oil barrel prices to find a floor at about $50 to $60 per barrel for the time being. But it is creating enough headaches for the world's largest energy players, such as ExxonMobil, Chevron, and Royal Dutch Shell, that could throw the entire U.S. economy in turmoil. The issue is this. Oil companies have amassed more than $200 billion in combined net debt, a number that has more than doubled in just 2 years. While the executives of these companies adamantly have indicated shareholder dividends will not be cut, the macro impact is what may be more concerning. With the mounting debt payment staring at these companies, and coupled with the dividend expenses, the question is, will these oil companies have enough money to innovate, invest, and acquire new technologies to fulfill the energy demands of the world? Looks like a barrel price of $55 or $60 is not working out for these companies. That eventually is going to lead into selling assets, changing operations, and closing centers, all resulting in thousands of lost jobs. That in turn will affect all the industries that have vendor relationships. So Texas, North Dakota, Nebraska, Kansas, and Oklahoma, watch out. Perhaps the most important element that is keeping these companies on track is the lower interest rates. That makes the debt payments a little easier. But what happens when rates start going up? We all know the answer to that. Macro scenarios such as these offer us a glimpse of an industry whose fortunes or hardships will have a direct impact on virtually all industries, from automakers to heavy goods manufacturing, and from transportation to housing. And consumers will feel the impact as costs get passed down all the way to the bottom. I don't see companies such as ExxonMobil or Shell cutting dividends in the near future. That could start a cascade of events spooking the entire investment community. Not to mention millions of retirees in the U.S. live off those dividends as part of their supplemental income. But I do see a scenario where states will use the economic plight of the oil companies to further push forward the sustainable energy narrative. Texas already is pushing for that change. The American Wind Energy Association ranks Texas, the top state in the nation, in terms of investments in wind projects, jobs related to wind energy industry, and total clean energy output. And all of that because of robust federal and Texas state incentives policies. Suffice to say, the winds are shifting. And also on the Viewpoint page, we have a Viewpoint column written by Mark Murrow, who is a senior fellow and policy director of the Metropolitan Policy Program at Brookings Institution in Washington, D.C. The headline on his Viewpoint column, Auto Sector Slowdown Spells Trouble. Hazards ahead. That's what data about the auto sector are signaling. Economic leaders and workers may want to buckle up. Caution lights are definitely blinking for the auto industry and the manufacturing sector more generally. August's new update on growth and change in America's 50 critical advanced industries showed that output growth slowed markedly in the three major auto industries during the last 2 years, while employment growth, still positive, leveled off. Meanwhile, sales for the three top automakers selling in the U.S. slipped in July, as the strong growth rate that has defined the past 6 years slowed to a crawl. Another indication that growth is plateauing after a six-year boom. A few weeks ago, Ford jolted the industry by saying sales have peaked and projecting a slower fall and a tough 2017. This is a sea change given the boom since 2010, and it matters a lot right now because auto is critical to the manufacturing sector. Auto-related industries, after all, delivered 70% of the nation's advanced manufacturing employment growth during the last 2 years. Given the slow growth over other manufacturing industries experienced in the face of a strong dollar and global headwinds. In keeping with that, the sector has become a crucial source of innovation, output, productivity, and new jobs, 90,000 plus direct ones in the last 2 years. As such, auto industries with their long supply chains contribute hugely to the prosperity of something like a quarter of the nation's largest metropolitan areas, arrayed along a corridor sweeping from the Great Lakes states into Kentucky, Tennessee, South Carolina, and Alabama. A significant swath of the country's Midwestern and Southern heartland has an elevated share of its employment in auto. All of which underscores that a further slowing of the auto sector, as appears to be beginning, could be an unfortunate development for the nation's steady but uninspiring economic expansion. The auto industry's recovery has been a bright spot for the U.S. economy, with the three major auto industries and four digital services delivering two-thirds of the nation's vital and sustaining advanced sector growth. If that goes away, the nation's advanced sector in multiple states and metro areas will have to contend with a further narrowing of an advanced sector growth base that is already too narrow. Losing auto as a strong job creator would, for one thing, take away one of the nation's few sizable sources of well-paying jobs for workers without a BA. The auto industry and other manufacturing industries are notable for continuing to pay decent wages to less educated workers. The nation needs more growth from its most accessible, high-value industries, not less. Similarly, a slowing of the auto sector would narrow the geography of growth across multiple heartland states and metropolitan areas. More dots would turn pink or red on the advanced industry employment growth map as hiring slowed. More regions would lose direct jobs, supplier jobs, and consumer spending. In that vein, a flattening of growth in the auto sector could well emerge as a substantial issue in the first year of a new president's administration. Momentum should keep hiring going through the election and keep a plateauing auto sector from worsening the distress already agitating the electorate in battleground states like Michigan and Ohio. But should auto growth slump and the mediocre 1.2% per year growth rate of the manufacturing sector slip further, the new president is going to be forced to address the status of the nation's advanced industry sector. Further slowing will make shoring up and expanding the advanced industry sector even more imperative than it already is. And in general news stories in the Triangle Business Journal, we have the headline, Aging Chapel Hill Apartments to Get Clubhouse Pool. This article is written by Lauren Onasorge. Grubb Properties has raised $27 million to kickstart the redevelopment of the historic Glen Lennox property in Chapel Hill. With a second funding close scheduled for the end of September, Grubb is readying to start the first phase of redevelopment in summer 2017, says Clay Grubb, CEO of Charlotte-based Grubb Properties. The who's who of my parents' generation all live there, he says, of the 440-unit apartment complex. It seems like the who's who of my generation was all born there. It really was the community to live in when you went to graduate school in Carolina. But the 64-year-old property, whose tenants have included UNC basketball coach Roy Williams, isn't what it used to be. Following 9/11, it lost many of its long-term clientele, he says. The complex his company had purchased from iconic North Carolina entrepreneur Frank Kennan, which boasted the second shopping center ever built in the state after Raleigh's Cameron Village, had lost some of its appeal. At some point, 60-year-old single-story, three-bedroom apartments with a tiny little bathroom and a pedestal sink, it gets tougher and tougher for people to get excited about living there, he says. You can't just stick with what it was and put it in a museum and hope it will prosper at some point. Grubb's bullish plan to bring back Glen Lennox's grandeur happens in gradual phases over the next two decades. For the first time in its history, Glen Lennox will have a community clubhouse, complete with its first swimming pool. The first phase also includes a modern workout facility at the clubhouse, along with a cafe area. And the company will build an office building, an outdoor recreation space, and a new 220-unit apartment community under Grubb's Link Apartments brand, which will be similar to other Link properties, such as what's in Raleigh's Glenwood South, across from 42nd Street Oyster Bar. Tenants who have lived on the property for 5 years or longer will have their rent capped at the Tax and Price Index, or TPI, but other rents are likely to increase. We think from a value basis you'll get more from your money, he says. Nearly 40 investors have contributed so far to Grubb's Glenn Lennox Fund, averaging about $850,000 each, he says. Grubb Properties has been an owner and manager of the 69-acre property since 1986, and its executives led the six-year effort to reach a formal development agreement with Chapel Hill town leaders for the multi-phase redevelopment. Dale Jr.'s Whiskey River, others coming to RDU. This article also written by Lauren Onasorge. Race car driver Dale Earnhardt Jr.'s Whiskey River concept, already an Epicenter Charlotte staple, is coming to Raleigh-Durham International Airport. It's one of five new restaurants coming to Terminal 2, approved August 18 by the RDU Airport Authority. Two of the concepts are short-term, set to debut this fall and shutter in fall 2017. Starbucks, to be located at Gate D14, and Tap Room, to be located at Gate D15, to feature a full bar alongside pub fare. And three concepts signed 10-year leases set to open in fall 2017, replacing the short-term concepts. Dale Jr.'s Whiskey River, to be located at Gate D14, described as a full-service restaurant with a stage for live music. Popeye's Louisiana Kitchen, to be located at Gate D15, a fast food concept featuring fried chicken, and Starbucks to replace the temporary unit at Gate D14. The selection process took several months. The airport put out its initial request for proposals in the spring and got two offers, says RDU spokesman Andrew Sawyer, Maryland-based travel restaurateur HMS host. It already operates restaurants in both terminals, but primarily Terminal 2, was ultimately selected. And Uptown Airport Group, which already operates establishments such as Terminal 1's Salsarita, had applied but was rejected. HMS will be building out the long-term options while the short-term restaurants are in operation in what will become patio space. When we opened Terminal 2, we opened it for future growth, Sawyer explains, adding that since the south end was vacant at the time, the airport decided not to populate it with shops and restaurants. Over the years, however, Terminal 2 grew as Alaska Airlines, Allegiant, Frontier, Air Canada, and overflown flights from the mainstream airlines all operate from that section of the airport. It's become quite busy. So what we've done is asked these companies to provide something very short-term, something they can bring off the ground really quickly, so there's an option, he says. And now in the Triangle Business Journal, we turn to the People on the Move page, where the spotlight is on Mike Woods, who is the VP and Eastern North Carolina GM at CCAC Building Solutions. On October 1, 2015, Greensboro HVAC contractor CCAC Building Solutions purchased Raleigh's BMS Mechanical. Mike Woods, who was the owner and general manager of BMS, was then named general manager of the combined company's Raleigh office. Fast forward to now, Woods has been given more responsibilities as CCAC's Eastern North Carolina general manager. In his new role, Woods is responsible for all aspects of CCAC's controls division and mechanical projects, including sales, installation, and profitability. He's also in charge of staffing his division. CCAC was founded in 1967 as Lacey Air Conditioning by Richard Lacey. It eventually became known as Central Carolina Air Conditioning. The company now has about 145 employees in its Greensboro and Raleigh offices combined. The company provides ongoing facility maintenance services, design build services, and green energy services. That includes preventative maintenance and service for its clients, including certified maintenance, assured maintenance, and plumbing services. What's one thing you wish people knew about your job? The great opportunities available in the mechanical contracting field. What are some of your major goals in your new position? Hiring quality individuals to grow our team is a major goal. Biggest pet peeve? People not doing things right the first time. I don't like things done halfway. Biggest worry? People not realizing all the opportunities that this industry has to offer. Family? Wife Robin, two children, Jennifer and Alan, two grandchildren, Kayla and Riley. Last book you've read? The Mind Connection by Joyce Meyer. And with our remaining minutes with the Triangle Business Journal, we'll read as much as we can of the Executive Voice column that focuses on John Dombrowski. The headline, Hooked on Fueling Ag Tech Innovation in North Carolina. And this is written by Jason DeBruin. In May, a new startup accelerator focused on emerging agricultural technologies launched with $11.5 million in backing from major players in the Triangle's life sciences industry. Called AgTech Accelerator, the group has backing from companies like Bayer and Syngenta and investment groups like Hatteras Venture Partners and Pappas Capital. Its goal is to grow the next generation of innovative agriculture companies. John Dombrowski, a Syngenta veteran, leads the AgTech Accelerator and discusses the intersection of agriculture and technology. Why is RTP the right place for this accelerator? The Triangle has a high concentration of big agriculture companies, three world-class research universities, a strong culture of entrepreneurism, and a rich base of talent. What are your immediate goals or benchmarks? Unlike traditional incubators, the AgTech Accelerator model begins with highly collaborative relationships at the academic setting and works with technical founders to establish high-impact product plans from technical proofs of concept. Our initial priorities, thus, are to establish these academic institutional relationships, describe the AgTech Accelerator platform's unique value creation elements, and form great startup companies. What are the kinds of companies AgTech Accelerator will look to invest in? We identify, invest in, and help manage high-value, early-stage technologies that will address some of the world's most pressing needs. Our model seeks to help bridge an existing translation gap by forming promising early-stage technologies into successful agricultural products. And as we're running out of time, we'll skip to the end and go to, if you could hang out with any three people, who would they be? Would have to be a full day breakfast with Pope Francis, watch Notre Dame beat USC with Newt Rockne, road trip home with Elon Musk. And we'll stop there as we run out of time for today's episode of Triangle Business Journal. Be sure to listen the same time next week. We hope you've enjoyed it. I'm Derek Frost, reading for the Triangle Radio Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for a blind and print-impaired audience. The program is readily available as a podcast after the broadcast. You can contact us at 919-832-5138. So long until next time.